And it is 22 minutes after the hour, it being a Tuesday. I say that almost every Tuesday, it being a Tuesday. I also typically add that Dr. Don Clark joins us from Garden Valley, Texas, and so it goes this Tuesday. Don is a biochemist, a member of the Board of Creation Moments, and he runs a grape ranch down there in Garden Valley. And Don, I figure the grapes are in their glory now. A little drizzle and mist and cooler temperatures, they're probably just bursting with juices. I think that's what grapes do.
Juice and goodness.
Yeah.
Well, they would be, but we don't have any grapes this year. We have vines.
What?
And the vines are quite happy now that the rains have come. I've stopped irrigating the whole vineyard with 10,000 gallons of water a day.
Sounds like substantial savings day. Here, yeah.
Okay.
How come there are no grapes? I thought you were not harvesting this year. Surely there are grapes out there.
Oh, there's some clusters of grapes, but no, we pruned the vines way back to just the main start to regrow the cordons, and then clipped off any grape buds that there were earlier in the spring to give the vines some rest.
All right.
This is their Sabbath. The year
giving your grapes some Z's this year. Mm-hmm. Walk out there, and all you hear is,
they're not struggling to produce fruit or to try to get it ripe.
No struggling or straining this year. Okay, alrighty.
How common is that, Don?
I've never heard of it here in the United States.
Really?
Yes.
Really? Nobody else. You're a trendsetter in this too.
Well, it's ancient, actually. It's an ancient practice that the Hebrews or the Jews are to practice on a 7-year cycle. If you look at Leviticus 25, which talks about the Sabbath year, the first thing that they mention is the vine, interestingly enough. Mm-hmm. And that we are to basically leave the vines alone and don't collect the fruit, and whatever fruit is there is for the animals and sojourners, but we aren't to necessarily do anything with the fruit that we would normally do.
Mm-hmm. In Israel, I did a quick check, and the Sabbath year is called a Shemitah.
The Shemitah, right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Shemitah. And it's the seventh year of the 7-year agricultural cycle mandated by the Torah for the land of Israel. So those who follow Torah learnings or teachings would do that as well in Israel.
Because number 7 again, 7 years, and then 7 cycles, and then you're to the Jubilee year. That's pretty cool.
And there are wineries or vineyards in Israel.
Yep, they do.
Yeah.
They do
yeah,
still
very
do
much
one.
So.
Mm-hmm. So
very
they would
much
do it.
So
they would do it there.
It'd be interesting to follow because I don't know if they do. Mm-hmm. They're supposed to, anyway, and you could do it a number of different ways. I mean, you know, you could have different fields at different ages where you're doing it every seventh year on a different field, so you're letting, you know, one field rests while you've got another field in production.
Well, of course, farmers do that anyway, rotating crops and so forth. They'll wait, but it's not necessarily the idea of a Sabbath so much as good farming practice. But that's where a lot of things derive, is from ancient writings and from the Bible most particularly. And it would behoove a lot of grape growers and people who work the land to adhere to that, I think. That could be a revolutionary old idea, Don. I think it's time.
Yeah, well,
come
we'll
again.
See. We'll see, you know, how the vines do in the next upcoming 6 years after that. And if they're, you know, more robust and produce much more crop, then we knew that we did the right thing. Of course, we knew that we did the right thing because both Andre and I were impressed that this is what we had to do this year.
Mm-hmm.
So we were in agreement.
All right. All right. Well, the topic today, we kind of talked about this, and we haven't touched on this for in some time. And for those of you maybe new to the station, Dr. Don's been with us now for good grief 7 years on the air. with just about every week, a few exceptions, but weekly discussions of things scientific and faith versus, well, not necessarily versus. Well, yes, versus. Science versus faith. They're not natural enemies, by the way. They go together beautifully when you look at the whole picture in an unbiased way. And that's what we're asking secular astronomers to do. They still claim that the universe is 13.8 billion years old or thereabout. They don't really know, you know, 10, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. That seems like quite a gap, but that's what their estimate is. And that the solar system is much younger than the universe, maybe 4.6 billion years old. How do they determine that, Don? I mean, what experimental you know, how do they collect data on that?
Oh, on the age of the universe, for example?
Yeah.
The age of the universe is determined by galaxy clusters, and you take your telescope and you see how far out you can see, and you get the faintest galaxy cluster. You can't even determine this by just one galaxy. It has to be a galaxy cluster so that mm-hmm. there's enough light for us to see. And, you know, the hypothesis that the further out you go, the more redshift there is, and therefore that can give us a estimate of the distance of those galaxies. And then we know what the speed of light is, supposedly. And therefore, if we know the distance and we know the speed of light, then we know how old that distant galaxy cluster is. That's how they determine how old the universe is.
Mm-hmm. And now, that's based on certain assumptions then.
It's based on a lot of assumptions.
Yeah.
It's based on the biggest assumption is you know the distance. I mean, you know the luminosity, that is, how bright the clusters are, with the assumption that okay, these galaxy clusters are of this type.
You can measure that with instruments here on Earth or in orbit.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. So, but you know, how far away are they? And then the other assumption, which I think is the critical error in this whole thing, is how fast is the speed of light through space?
Hmm.
And we assume that the speed of light is constant. And that's, you know, a given physical parameter. But as we've spoken of before, light is certainly bent by gravitational and space is, how do I want to say it? It's distorted by massive objects mm-hmm. in space.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that has been confirmed, quite accurately.
So let me take another look at this. So they're saying that, you know, light travels in a straight line. So if we have a dim galaxy cluster out there somewhere, and we figure the speed of light, and we can calculate the distance from that because the redshift tells us over time how the radio. No, I'm getting lost here, but the point is, I didn't become an astronaut. So
yeah, the Hubble equation, which basically says that the greater the redshift, the farther the object is. But okay. You have actually two measurements of, in quote, distance. One is the luminosity, how bright it is. And so you assume, okay, these galaxies should have this brightness if they were this close, but they're much dimmer than that, so they've got to be much farther away. And, you know, that's a relatively simple, you know, calculation.
But that involves an assumption, too. You just described the assumption. And furthermore, if light doesn't really travel in a straight line, but it's bent, it's traveling a much farther distance than they're estimating for.
Yeah. Well, which then would mean that that the universe is actually older than it is.
Yeah.
Now, my point in all of this is that light is the apparent speed of light. Now, I want to say apparent because if you went out in any part of space to measure light, you would get the same number. But space is not uniformly constant. In other words, you know, space has some fabric. There is fabric to space. Einstein, when he first started with his special theory of relativity, he was under the assumption that space was empty. But by the time he got to his general relativity, he says, no, space is everything. There is a fabric to space, and space can be distorted, and it's distorted by mass. And so it's denser spaces, if you will, denser around heavy objects than when, you know, when there's empty space. You can think of that then as empty space is stretched out. And so if that is the case, that if empty space is stretched out, then light would travel the apparent speed of light through stretched out space where there's not any matter, would be faster than light traveling in space near heavier objects like the solar system or galaxies and the like. Mm-hmm. Therefore, if that is indeed the case, and there's a lot of, you know, there is a lot of evidence that that probably is the case, then you can't say how old that distant object is, especially if you don't know how fast the light is traveling through this empty space, if you will. So, you know, it could be that the light that we see from distant galaxy reaches the Earth within 2 weeks, unlike reaches the Earth in 13.8 billion light years, you know. So
kind of a wide margin for error there.
Yeah, it is a wide margin for error. So anyway, that that kind of you know, argument as far as the assumption of how we go about calculating the age of the universe is in suspect, because we really don't know what the apparent speed of light is in the middle of space, for example, where there's no gravity, or there's no heavy objects.
Okay, well, we're talking now about deep space. What about objects closer? In other words, what the moon, as I recall, was 239,000 miles away or something. That's a matter of bouncing a laser beam off the moon and timing it, or it might be triangulation, working from opposite ends of the Earth's orbit around the sun. I think that's another tool they use. Are they more accurate at measuring close things?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Because these, I mean, we're talking about, you know, great distances, and the and we're talking about, okay, the moon is not that far away from the Earth, for example. I mean, the Earth is pretty far away from the sun, but those short distances, and you've got, if you will, compressed space anyway, because you've got the Earth and then you've got the moon, and the more massive a object is, the more space is compressed around it, so you would have the space around the sun, for example, would be more compressed than the space around the moon. But those effects are much, much less because of the closeness of the distance.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, if you're talking about, you know, fractions of, you know, of a I can't even, you know, of a millisecond or a microsecond or a nanosecond, it's going to be, you know, hard to measure anyway.
So the point is that space is not a void. It's not empty between heavenly bodies out there. There's stuff there that acts. I'm now getting a picture of space as, well, you mentioned fabric, maybe even a fluid of sorts, even just countless particles of things that are attracted to planets and to stars and to clusters of them, and concentrated as you get closer to them, because all this stuff is pulled around by gravitational pull.
Well, right. And then what is gravity? Mm-hmm. I mean, one way of looking at gravity, as Einstein looked at it, is it's a distortion in space. So, take a drum, for example, a drum head. Suppose you had a rubber drum head, mm-hmm. and then you put a marble on the drum head. It's going to distort the drum head, depending on how tight it is. It's going to distort the drum head where the marble is. Now, if you took a lead ball and put it on the drum head, then it's going to distort it more. And then if you rolled a marble, a lighter object, it's going to, and if you roll it properly, but if the lead ball is in the middle of the drum head, so everything is kind of dipping down towards the middle, you roll the marble is going to start to rotate around the lead ball. That's pretty much a description. It's in two dimension. Well, it's in three dimension, but it gives you an idea of the distortion of space around heavy objects.
That's a good example. I can see that. I can picture that. Yeah.
And, what gravity, could be like. And gravity being another way of describing it is just a distortion of space. Now, saying all of that, we've been talking about the universe. The solar system, it's a lot easier to see a young solar system. So, the conventional wisdom is that the solar system is 4.6 billion years old. And, we know that by radiometric dating of the rocks that we've collected from the moon and from the earth, and it looks like we got some reasonable age for the earth, I mean for the solar system. Well, do we? Because if the solar system is that old, and the conventional wisdom is that the planets spun out from the sun, there's another problem with that, but let's assume that assumption is correct. And then over billions of years, the sun is cooling down. If the sun were, 4 billion or 4.6 billion years old, it would be frozen here on Earth. In other words, we know how much energy there is in the sun. We know how much energy is being burned in the sun, how much nuclear fuel there is. We know the composition of the sun, so we can determine then how hot or how cold it should have been if it is 4.6 billion years old. If you look at the sun, and you look at the data from the sun, and you look and say, how old does the sun look like it could be? You get an age which is very, very close to, the sun could be very young. The sun could be 6,000 years, the data fit. Mm-hmm. So we go from 4.6 billion years to actually looking at the data, and it says, this sun is pretty young. And so, indeed, a solar astronomer, John Eddy, once said that the observational data of the sun do not demand an age of billions of years, and scientists could live with an age of 6,000 years for the Earth and the sun. So even a solar astronomer is saying, the data could fit that. That's not a problem. But the data cannot fit the sun being billions of years old, and therefore the Earth being, billions or millions and millions of years old. So that's one proof that we do indeed have a young solar system.
So secular scientists must look at that and say, I must re-examine my original premise. But that's not happening, is it?
It's not being publicized. Mm-hmm. Because if you publish something like that, that's going to be the last paper you publish if you can get it published. I mean, you know, that, the peer pressure to to keep the deep time and things old is so great that, you know, scientists that say that want to be honest and say, hey, you know, this could be 6,000 years old. That's the last article they're going to get published because we don't want to hear that. We don't want to hear that there might be a creator. Now, it gets worse than that because we've got this thing around the Earth. It's called the magnetic field. Now, we know that the magnetic field, we can measure it, and we know that the magnetic field is decreasing over time, that the energy in the magnetic field is decreasing. And the half-life, we've even measured the half-life of the energy in the magnetic field. And the half-life, that is, that half of it's losing half of its energy every 1,400 years or so, you know, plus or minus. Okay, well, if you know the half-life, then you can go back and calculate what was the intensity of the magnetic field, let's say 10,000 years ago or 20,000 years ago. You come up with a calculation that says the energy is so great in the magnetic field that the Earth's crust would not be solid any later than 10,000 years ago. In other words, there couldn't be any life on Earth if you go back further than 10,000 years. So that, you know, that kind of puts an outer limit, if you will, for how old the Earth probably is. And if you look at other planets, which Russell Humphreys has done, and actually did calculations before measurements were even taken of Uranus and Neptune, for example, he showed that the magnetic dipole, if you will, of these planets should be such and such. And lo and behold, when they go to measure it, one, they were surprised that it even had a dipole, because it should have degraded along the same way with the Earth, by the way. It should have degraded long, long, long ago if it was billions of years old. That one, they had a dipole, and that Russell Humphreys was correct based on his creation model that these planets and the Earth are, you know, 6,000 years old. The magnetic field that has been studied quite extensively and has been shown that, hey, because there's a magnetic field, these planets, our planet, can't be that old. The planets around us can't be that old. And indeed, it points to a young Earth.
So the evidence is there, and it's not getting out.
It's not getting out. And you would think that this would be something that would be, you know, published in astronomy or cosmology type of periodicals. But the only place it's being published is, like, for example, in the Institute of Creation Research, where they, you know, they publish articles like this. It's disturbing that we continue to propagate this concept that the Earth, the solar system, the universe is quite old and therefore supports the evolutionary theory. But when we go and actually look at the data from a number of perspectives and warm bodies, I mean, the planets are warmer than and their moons are a lot warmer than they're supposed to be. Which means that they have a lot more energy in them than they should be if they're as old as they claim to be. Mm-hmm. So even that suggests that they're, you know, that everything is young.
Okay. Well, it's interesting that there's all this out there and people aren't hearing about it, and And maybe we've helped with that just a little bit this morning. Got some of that information out. And looking forward to more. If you're interested in following up with this and listening, there's a now a link in the chat window to the same article that we've been looking at this morning. And you can kind of look for yourself and decide just how valid this idea is, that both the solar system and the universe itself are actually much younger than is the standard measurement, that the standard has been called into question and the word isn't getting out. If you'd like to find out more about this and other biblically substantiated theories and experimentation and data, you can take a look at the Creation Moments website, creationmoments.com. That's .com, creationmoments.com. You can go there and you'll find a wealth of resources in the form of DVDs and articles and conversations and blogs. And I think you'd be impressed with this, the amount of scientific information there is that supports a young Earth and supports the whole idea that, yep, there's a creator. Don, thanks very much for joining us. Appreciate having you along.
And, oh, you're quite welcome.
We'll check with you next week.
Okay, you folks have a great week.
Thank you. Thanks. Bye-bye.
You too, Don.